Hello and welcome to this episode of Invest Africa Insights. Global leaders are gathering in Glasgow this week for COP26. The landmark talks have been billed as the last chance to keep global heating below 1.5 degrees Celsius, the threshold after which scientists say the climate crisis begins to spiral out of control. As policymakers look to galvanize the global community behind an ambitious set of climate goals, it is crucial that Africa is not left behind. Despite contributing the least of any region to global greenhouse gas emissions, Africa is set to bear the brunt of many of the impacts of climate change. We're already seeing these impacts, from flooding in East Africa to more frequent droughts across the continent. And as more extreme climate events increase in frequency, they pose an ever more serious threat to lives and livelihoods. Without significant investment now in climate adaptation and mitigation, Africa could find its socioeconomic development set back significantly. And of course, the question on everyone's mind is, how can Africa secure the financing it needs to meet its climate goals? And how high on the agenda will this issue be at COP26? So my guest today to talk us through how to mobilize more investment in Africa's climate resilience is Marco Serena,
Head of Sustainable Development Impact at the Private Infrastructure Development Group.
Marco, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, Marco, obviously, this is a huge issue, you know, if not sort of the most important issue that that we face globally. And even though the Paris Climate Agreement was a significant step forward, it's clear that progress hasn't been made nearly fast enough. And, you know, earlier this year, we had the UN issuing a code red for humanity on the climate crisis. So to start us off, it'd be really great to get your view from your perspective sitting within development finance, as to why it is that progress on this issue, particularly in developing markets, has been quite challenging, and whether you're feeling optimistic that COP26 will act as the sort of catalyst that it needs to be to drive more climate finance into Africa.
Thanks, Eleanor. As you say, the whole issue of climate finance is crucial for Africa for the reasons that you've highlighted. As you know, at the Private Infrastructure Development Group, we are infrastructure developer and financiers. So infrastructure is really at the core of that triple challenge there of addressing the urgent needs to progress on the Sustainable Development Goals, not just Goal 13, but the goals of reducing poverty and access to electricity, access to water, which is still lacking especially in Africa. And then the challenge of doing this in a way that is resilient to climate, because as we know, all socioeconomic development has been associated with increase in carbon emissions in the past. So we need a different way of doing that. And the third big challenge is, how do we do all of this in the middle of a prolonged pandemic, which has caused a shortage of capital and all sort of behaviors that have gone against what is needed in order to meet those targets and plans. So infrastructure development is funding is crucial. And I think it's important to notice that we've got a code red on curbing greenhouse gas emission, but we've also got a code red as in, for the first time, the gains that have been made on the Sustainable Development Goals, in particular in reducing poverty, are being reversed due to the pandemics. So I think here lies the challenge. On one side, the most urgent thing to do is to curb greenhouse gas emissions. And that is the responsibility largely of countries who are already industrialized. On the other side, the impacts of the climate change, if you're thinking about rising sea levels and extreme weather events, as you mentioned before, are mainly happening in Africa and in Asia. And so it is important to do two things. One, invest in the resilience of the African continent in particular, and on people on the African continent, as well as support infrastructure that can help a faster transition towards low carbon emission. In the awareness that It's greenfield infrastructure that we need in Africa at the moment, given the SDG needs. And that is more challenging. Now, am I optimistic about COP? There's a lot at stake for the planet, as you are aware. And I think there are many parties going to COP with commitments, which is encouraging. But whether Africa and finance for climate resilience and for a just transition will receive enough attention is still to be seen.
No, and you've touched on sort of a lot of some of the tensions there, I suppose, that exist in sort of thinking about the climate crisis in Africa, and particularly this issue that obviously Africa is also at the heart of a lot of the global SDGs. So how do you then, as PIDGE, as a group, think about balancing your goals around poverty reduction, more social inclusion, gender equality, with goals around climate? How do you balance those two? Are they contradictory, or is there a way that they can sort of be mutually reinforcing?
So these two are complementary goals for us. So on one side, we need to prioritize creating jobs and putting in place infrastructure that addresses basic needs. So access to electricity is still lacking for millions of people in rural areas, and the access to electricity is still very low in proportional terms as well in terms of access to the grid, even in urban areas. So access to water and sanitation is still lagging. And of course, poverty levels, as we mentioned before, are still high. So we need to address those. But the key thing is, how do we do that? And do we do that in a way that creates stranded assets? Because in 20 years, we're going to see, or in 10, 20 years, we're going to see increasingly things like possibly import taxes on the carbon content of products, or we're going to see assets which are not resilient to the climate shocks that are increasing. Or do we do that by future-proofing our thinking? And that's what we're trying to do. So we apply a screen to each investment that we make, in which we look at the sustainable development goals as a whole. We look at the expected impact on people, planet, wider economy, and transforming markets. And we take into account what type of emissions we're looking in. But crucially, we're also looking at the resilience to climate of the investments that we are funding. And we're doing that in two ways. We're looking at the resilience of the asset, so taking into account, for example, that water levels are going to rise quicker than we originally expected when we were planning some of the port infrastructure. But at the same time, we're looking at the resilience of the people and the community who are going to use that infrastructure. And so is that infrastructure going to increase the resilience of the people, or is it going to put that into jeopardy? And so that's the type of analysis that we're doing, is a long-term analysis. And I think that's that's absolutely a must for infrastructure investment, given the timelines that are involved. We're putting together, we are funding infrastructure that is going to be in place for 20, 30 years. So it's essential that today we are looking at the long-term and the impact. So I don't think it is a trade-off between poverty reduction and climate. I think it's just a matter of looking at what are the possibilities to advance a just transition. Now, the big question is, can we leapfrog technology? Can we replace technology that is high emitting? And it's easier in some sectors than in others. So it's easier in, for example, rural electrification, where we know that mini grids and solar mini grids can play a very important role. It is less easy in some of the inputs to infrastructure. So, for example, difficult to abate sectors like cement and steel. But at the same time, there are developments in the sector that mean that Africa can look at moving faster towards the more sustainable solutions than others have done before.
Now, Mark, I mean, obviously, you know, it's one thing, one challenge to identify where investment needs to go and what the sort of priorities need to be. And then it's another thing to try and leverage the finance that you need to make those investments. And Pidge plays quite an interesting role in that respect in investing yourselves, but also trying to mobilize further private capital. So I was wondering from, you know, from your perspective, what are your priorities when it comes to attracting more international investors and more private investors to think about climate finance in Africa?
Well, the key focus of Pidge is to bring private sector where it wouldn't otherwise go. And we've been in operation for 20 years now with our long-term debt fund, Emerging Africa Infrastructure Fund. And then we, together with that, we've got a product offer that spans guarantees, local currency solutions, as well as project development and technical assistance and viability gap funding. And all these things need to come together in order to bring private sector where it wouldn't otherwise go. There is a lot of talk now about blended finance. And I was looking at some of the recent reports on blended finance. Very, very little goes to these developed countries. You're talking less than 5%. And actually very few DFIs are involved directly in blended finance deals. And we've got a structure that allow us to do those. So, for example, we shouldn't be under the impression that there are a lot of pension funds in Europe or elsewhere just waiting to invest in countries that are where in some of the African countries where there is high perception of risk at the moment. And I think that the key thing is we need to develop and create the projects for capital to invest. And so the early stage work that we do in doing all the feasibility assessments and looking at bringing the opportunity to the level of standards on health and safety, environmental standards, ESG, that international investors will require is absolutely crucial. And we're doing that at the project level. There's a wider piece, which is about building capacities of institutional counterparts as well, which some of the multilateral do. But we really focus on the specific capacities that are needed to make a deal happen. And that's where our early stage technical assistance is absolutely crucial in terms of developing future deals. And then there's the second piece, which is really developing projects. If you look at Africa, there are very few project developers at the moment in the infrastructure space, private project developers who act at the regional level. And obviously, our company Infraco Africa is one of those, and plays an important role in that. It's about deploying two type of capital there. The equity, the early stage equity investment, which is needed, which is sometimes less than 10% of the infrastructure cost, but is absolutely crucial then to allow that to come in afterwards. And then in terms of other type of investments, it's more is almost a venture capital type of finance. For example, in some of the deals that we're doing now on electric vehicles. And the role there is crucial because there's been a lot of talk since 2015 onwards of scaling up from billion to trillions of finance. But the reality is that we need to develop the projects in which finance can be deployed, and that is key. Obviously, then if we're talking about climate finance, it just increases the level of standards that we need to. That we need to focus on, because you are adding there some technology risks to on top of all the systemic risks that you already have on the continent. So that's that's part of the challenge there, developing the projects. And then I think the other part is connecting those to international investors. And that's where I think that both our credit solutions play an important role. And it's really important to have the right type of finance for infrastructure projects, which is long term. And how many entities will provide 15, 20, 25 year debt at the moment? Very few. So I think that's where the track record that our debt fund has created on the continent is absolutely crucial to show others that this is possible with relatively small losses, investing in frontier geographies. We've got over 50% of our investment in least developed countries, over 50% of our investment in fragile and conflict affected states, and relatively low level of loss to on our debt portfolio, which means that it is possible to make these investments stack up. And the final piece, by no means the least, is really around local investors. We know that institutional investors in Nigeria, in South Africa, in Kenya, increasingly, are sitting on very substantial sums of investable capital. So the key part is, how do we unlock those through local currency solutions, through guarantees, through showing that it is viable, and also through a dialogue with local stakeholders in emerging markets in Africa about what does a transition look like, a just transition to net zero look like for these countries, because we know it's going to be different from what a transition looks like for the countries who have already industrialized.
That's such an interesting point. I think, you know, that local investment point is often overlooked in these conversations. We focus a lot on international investors. So perhaps we could just stay on that for a moment. I know that you do work with local capital markets. It'd be great to hear a bit more about how you do that. And I also know that you've sort of recently helped Kenya with launching its first green bonds. And so I'd be curious to hear more about how that local capital market piece fits in and how important it is to your approach.
That piece is absolutely crucial. We are looking at plugging the infrastructure investment gap, and developing local capital markets is absolutely essential to do that. And there are a number of ways in which we're doing that. We think that guarantees play a very, very important role in demonstrating the viability of infrastructure as an asset class for local investors in local currency. And there are a number of ways in which we do that. At the deal by deal level, we're looking at pathfinding transactions in a country where there are first of a kind issuances from private companies, and more and more these become very important in terms of climate finance mobilization. So you mentioned the Kenya green bond, the first commercially issued Kenya green bond about 18 months ago now, and which effectively attracted capital for solutions for green buildings in student accommodations. And I think what the guarantee does there is allowing the first of a kind type of transactions. And there's a lot of work that goes on before the issuance on screening the market, finding the right partners, and effectively backing entrepreneurs and companies who understand that they are effectively investing resources into what is, the perceived or real additional cost of green bond certification, while the certainty of the green premium is still not there because they are the first. But at the same time, you know, that first mover, that first mover will then be able to tap into a pool of capital that is not available to everybody else. So effectively, what we've been doing is backing first movers in a number of countries. And we hope to replicate similar structure very soon in a different country in Southern Africa. And there are a number of others. And then we think that's not enough, because what's really needed is for local institutions who are completely embedded in the local market, where the market is big enough, to work with sponsors and with potential funders on doing more of the same effectively. And that's where there's such an important role for entities like InfraCredit Nigeria, which was launched 3 years ago now, together with the Nigerian Sovereign Investment Authority, by Pitch Company Garanco, and invested now by Pitch as a group, which is really looking at demonstrating the viability of infrastructure as an asset class through the issuance of guarantees in local currency that effectively are improving the credit rating of the deals in order to attract potential investors. We think this will be more and more important in the future, and I think is that the combination of these two aspects: on one side, developing the projects or supporting project developers so that there are things to be invested in. On the other side, working on the prep work that is needed in order to prime the pump of potential green bonds and do that first issuance and that second and third, so that the market can understand that it's actually feasible to do that in these markets.
And it sounds like, sort of on some level, a big part of the issue is really sort of building trust and building trust in green standards and in practices. And you know, on that issue, it can be quite confusing for a lot of people because we have so many different goals and metrics and standards. You've got the SDGs, you've got the principles for responsible investing, you know, you've got lots of different standards. So do you think that it would be helpful globally if we move towards a more standardized set of standards on some of these sustainability issues, as we have with financial metrics, or do you think it's sort of the system as it is working fine?
I think it's absolutely needed, and I think the key way is, how do we do that? So on one side, we need effectively global standards. On the other side, there is a real risk that African markets are going to suffer from the fact that it's going to take more effort and more cost to implement these standards in any African country that is going to take in any developed market. And that cost is at the moment not factored in. But there's an additional element. If we're doing a bond that allows energy access in rural areas for rural clinics, for rural schools in any African country, say Malawi or Sierra Leone, effectively what we're doing is we are improving on the most urgent SDGs globally. We are improving climate resilience, and we are building capacities to meet the standards that will allow those markets to leapfrog the technology that has been used elsewhere. So we are allowing that type of sustainable development impact, which is what is needed, because we know that most of the population growth and urbanization come from emerging markets, and in particular from Africa. So all of that goes absolutely unnoticed, and there's no signal to the market for that. The only signal at the moment is, are we reaching certain benchmarks or certain standards or not? And all the standards that have been put in place so far are do no harm standard, unbanded, non-graded, and voluntary. So there's an issue of standardization there, but there's also an issue of, are these the type of standards that are needed? And I believe there's you're right, it took 200 years to develop accounting. We do need more effort, although it will take a little bit longer, to factor in the impact on people and planet of the investments that we're making and to put a cost to it. And it's high time that we do that because that's what the market is asking. So the market is asking for capital with purpose. ESG is becoming mainstream, and this is all to be welcome. But we need to come of age in a sense and really look more broadly, not just at the do no harm standards, but at, you know, the what are sometimes called the co-benefits or the you know, the socioeconomic impact of the investments that we're putting in place, and finding ways to price that, because it's an investment that effectively makes a return for everyone, but it would be a mistake to count as externality, because it's not an externality anymore in the sense that if the if the countries in which we are investing develop without taking into consideration both the socioeconomic needs, which are very urgent, together with the future climate trajectory, then the whole planet is gonna pay for it. So I think that's the dilemma, and that's where standards should really, really help. There's a lot of attention in Glasgow and around COP by civil society, and I think that's welcome. But I think there's a lot of attention to avoid greenwashing, which I think is a very important topic. I think standards that are simpler and standards that are that work for private investors, while at the same time taking into account not just the do no harm aspect, but the benefits that the investments are putting in place, are effectively the way to go. And that's what we're trying to implement within the group in terms of our assessment of investments and our portfolio management and our capital allocation mechanisms.
And obviously, as a group, you know, you're working in some of the most fragile states in the world. How do you work as a group to make sure that those countries that are most fragile or maybe face challenges around conflict are remembered in the conversations that we're having around climate?
Well, if you look at our climate strategy, we really put emphasis on that, and we believe that is part of the role. We've been working with the first independent power producer in Chad for years. We know how difficult it is. We've done first IPPs in a number of countries. We've recently launched the first battery energy storage system associated to a non-grid in Malawi, and it's one of the first outside of South Africa, and we know how hard it is, but we also know that it's possible, and we also know that when we manage to get others to invest with us, sometimes obviously. As an investor, you're prepared to make some losses, although it's not what you want. But overall, if you look at the portfolio, we're demonstrating that it's possible to invest in these frontier geographies and yet preserving capital, making a return, and making it stack up in terms of acceptable rate of returns for private companies. And I think that is the message that we keep bringing to others, and we think that is the risk, that if this message is not loud enough, what we risk is effectively capital moving decisively towards reconverting the high polluting the high emitting infrastructure in currently industrialized countries. And it will be a double whammy for African markets if we only focus on immediate greenhouse gas emissions. We need to focus on climate resilience and on the additional benefit that investing in these countries is bringing. And we need to keep reminding investors and decision makers that if you're looking at where the country, where the people most vulnerable to climate change are, in the next 10, 15 years, 20 years, they will be concentrated in a handful of countries, and many of these countries are in Africa. So it's really crucial to invest there now, and we'll keep we very much see keep reminding this message as part of our role.
Now, Mark, I always like to try and end on a somewhat positive note. I know this is an issue that sort of that can weigh quite heavily. In lots of ways, it's quite existential. But if when you're looking at the progress that's been made or that Pidge has made as a group, is there anything that stands out or trend that makes you feel optimistic about the future, or any particular project that made you feel optimistic about the direction of travel?
Well, there's a lot that makes me feel optimistic about the type of work that we're doing. We know it's difficult, but we also know it's positive. I lived for 3 or 4 years in Sierra Leone a few years ago, and to see some of the results of people and communities being connected through mini grids in very, very remote rural areas. You're talking of 5% access to electricity in rural areas in Sierra Leone. And to see clinics connected, schools connected, and businesses starting to appear because of access to electricity gives me a lot of hope. And this is not just my micro. What gives me hope is that now you start having a few of those investments in a number of countries and moving progressively out of being grant funded and going towards a more commercial type of investment and possibly reaching a scale that will demonstrate their viability as an asset class. So that's exciting because access to electricity in rural areas is one of the great challenges of our time. And how do we do that will impact so significantly our climate challenges as well. And then I think the other thing that gives me hope is to see that we're investing in Africa 60-65%. It's always above 50%, but some of the records are 60-65% in fragile and country and conflict affected states, and yet we've got a portfolio that is holding. So it must be possible, and it's not because we're doing things so much, we're doing things so much better than others. I think it just, we're there to demonstrate the viability of frontier investments, and we're doing it. And I think that is that is my message of hope, if you like. It is possible. It is difficult, but it is also possible. So that's the, that's the positive note for me ahead of COP. And I think really is about amplifying the message and also investing in solutions that are proving to be working and creating those partnerships that are needed so that we can not reinvent the wheel all the time and not make the same mistakes all the time, but work with those who are on the ground in the markets and are making things happening and help them, back them so that they can scale up. I mean, if you're looking at the energy on the continent, is immense in terms of the population, the age of the population. It can be an engine of growth, and I think we very much see our role being able to show that things are possible on the continent, that capital can go there and invest, and we really hope that COP will make a big difference to that. We know next COP is in Africa, so this must be a launch pad for the continent to do more and to show the way of how just transition to net zero can happen.
Marco, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to me today.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much.
And if anyone wants to know more about Pidge, there will be some links in the description. So do have a look there for a bit more information.